We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Whether or not Joe Maddon is involved in the current discussions that are going on at Wrigley Field, I do not know. But he made it very, very clear how he feels about his guys, even though baseball is holding more sway than they may have held in the past. The game, as it stands, is on. The latest forecast calls for 17-mile-an-hour west-northwest winds. So that would be foul pole to foul pole,
yeah.
Right? About left to right.
Yeah.
And 36 degrees actual air temperature. That is not factoring in wind chill.
That's really cold.
Yeah, that's too cold for baseball.
It's really cold.
It's as much as I want to watch Cubs baseball, I want it to be actual representative baseball that it was not when they last played.
Yeah, you know, I've complained about this for a little while, and it's more so, it's not that players have to go out. We're deciding games with something other than what we decide games with for 150 some games out of the year, right? Whether we play the World Series on November 4th, you know, game 7, or whether it's we play, you know, 3 weeks like this, it's not the same environment. Swinging strike rates are way up. Guys are throwing more balls this season at an alarming rate, like 5% more often now. In the first 3 weeks of the season, we're doing this differently, and it's affecting the game as we know it. We've already had so many things. Home run rates are all kind of wonky and stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so than when we introduced the new ball after the All-Star break a couple of years ago. They are still weird this season, it seems. Fly ball rates and home run rates. So we're dealing with a game that's just not the same thing. It's just not.
You mentioned weird. The Cubs season has been really weird. And I think this is a good job here in The Athletic. Patrick Mooney goes through just what's going on. Five times already this year through 14 games, five times the Cubs have scored one run or fewer. They've scored 72 runs, which puts them near the top of the National League. But that is skewed by five games where the lineup generated a combined 53 runs. This is what Len Casper was talking
sure.
about, too. The Cubs have played five opponents who finished last season an average of 18 games out of first place. Only the Brewers had a winning record last year, and the Cubs won three of four games at Miller Park. So it's just getting very strange. It's interesting to note the opposing starting pitchers during this start where the Cubs haven't had any real sense of momentum. The starting pitchers, Jose Urena, Caleb Smith, Otis Romer Despain, Dylan Peters, Tyler Malley, Brent Suter, Brandon Woodruff, Zach Davies, Chase Anderson, Ivan Nova, Stephen Brault, Trevor Williams, Anibal Sanchez, Sean Newcomb.
Stephen Brault.
From that group, there are zero All-Star selections.
Anibal Sanchez was never an All-Star.
Only Sanchez, who was released by the Twins in spring training, ever showed up in Cy Young Award voting. That was in 2013.
Oh, that's right. He had a big second half.
This is great work by Mooney here.
This is good work.
Their combined salary this season is almost $23 million, or less than what the Cubs are paying Yu Darvish this
year.
So if you think the Cubs season has been weird, you are right. It has been decidedly weird.
Then it's not, the weather adds into it, but the offense is I think, kind of independent of weather here, as Mooney's talking about it, right? Because you've got a guy in Chris Bryant who's putting up stellar numbers. I mean, he and Freddie Freeman, I think, lead the league in on-base percentage. It's something ridiculous, like 430, 440, something like that. It's just been a strange up-and-down kind of start to a season.
The Cubs are 10th in MLB in weighted on-base average as a team at 325. We should note the White Sox are 8th at 329. So they have been able to compile a lot of the stuff in these lopsided games.
That'll make for frustrating watching, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't start to get those things evening out a little bit either.
Cubs are 25th of the 30 MLB teams in pitching war. They are at 0.7 as a team in F war from their pitchers. The only teams worse, the Rays, the Royals, the Athletics, the Mariners, and the very, very unfortunate Reds.
Run prevention. That's what we talked about heading into the season. That's what this game is now. It's run prevention, hopefully with your starting pitching, especially as the Cubs have thrown a bunch of money into it and developed it some. A couple of texts coming in, and some of them missing the point in general about the weather.
Texters missing the point?
Yeah. Very simple from the 630. Start 1 to 2 weeks later and schedule doubleheaders again ahead of time during the season. That's not going to happen.
Right. That's the opposite of what they want to happen.
It won't happen. Players don't want to do that. This from the 815. Shut up, Connor. They're professional athletes with trainers. Deal with it. You know what trainers really struggle at fixing?
Make you impervious to cold?
It does. It does. Trainers are very, very – we're close, but we're not exactly there in fixing the dislocated shoulder or the severed knee or a Tommy John surgery. It's very difficult to fix these things in time for an October run for a team. It just – that doesn't happen. And if you don't think managers – we talked about La Russa earlier. If you don't think managers are – you know what Joe Maddon's thinking when he's walking out the front door right now? He's got Anthony Rizzo set to come off the disabled list today. You think he wants to look out in this snow, this weather, that wind chill, those winds, and be like, hey, Anthony, you know that lower back that you've been dealing with
stiffness.
The last day? Head on out there. You're fine. Everything's going
to
be good.
And he mentioned that when Baez slid in the outfield grass to make the play that he did, and then there was this pause, and I think he paused because he soaked an entire leg. Like, he got up and he was completely wet. You know, we were joking. I was laughing because remember we were joking with Crane Kenny when we were at Smoke Daddy talking about the area of that dugout where players didn't want to be seen. He said, you know, going over strategy or whatever. And I said, or change pants. I was completely joking about it just because I like saying pants because pants is a funny word. And that was my first thought. That there's Javier Baez. I was like, damn it, I need a new pair of pants already.
Ted Lilly always used to complain about those dugouts because he'd have to – Lilly would go through on a summer day like three jerseys. The dude would just sweat through jerseys, full actual baseball jerseys, sweat right through them, and he never had a place to change. He always had to walk back up the tunnel, and he just kind of wishes he could pop one wreck on there.
Such a weirdo.
Oh, yeah, but fun.
So, Ted Lilly,
fun to watch.
Didn't he get in trouble for...
Yeah.
Wasn't he like a large-scale fraud conviction as far as selling RVs or something? I think he had a not so legit business, either like refurbishing or some sort of third party RV brokering.
Nothing has sounded more like money laundering. Despite news over the weekend, nothing has sounded more like money laundering than you saying third party RV renovation.
I don't know exactly what it was, but there was something he was doing that was less than above board, and he got caught on it, and he got either indicted or fined, and just odd.
When you're filling the memo field on your checks with reupholstering RVs, well, it's not a great sign. This Winnebago needs a paint job. Does it?
No, somebody could. Or he was selling. Something was not kosher regarding his involvement in some aspect of the RV industry. Because you know how a lot of players, they retire, they get involved in some businesses maybe.
They've got a friend who's done this for years, and now he's got a chance to help. And
it ends up, it's their money, and they're just trying to find a place to park some money for whatever purpose. But and he got mad at me when I asked him, do you like baseball? Because he never...
Ted Lilly got mad at you?
Yeah, he did. He's like, what do you mean? I love baseball. Because when you play it, you never look like you're having fun. You always look unhappy. And he's like, well, it's my job.
You see his swing? Going to the National League, that would make someone unhappy, having that swing.
But it's like the opposite of Francisco Lindor.
Yeah.
You know, the opposite of some of these guys. Just
always having fun.
Couldn't be having more fun. And he always made it look dreary and intense. I mean, the glove throw.
Well,
the famous three-run homer playoff glove toss.
He was around for late Cub Aramis Ramirez, too. You know, the checkout factor, I think, in that clubhouse was at times peaking.
Buying the tickets to head home before the series was over.
Yeah, I think, speculation of that kind of idea was up there. And the couple of texts, too. Why can't you just make a roof? Why can't just every ballpark have a roof? Well, they tried. But some people just don't want to pay for it. Like in Minneapolis, they ran out of money. They flat out ran out of money and didn't want to pay for a roof. And people didn't want to vote them into a roof.
In January 2015, Lilly was charged with three counts of vehicle insurance fraud. He accepted a plea bargain to pay a $2,500 fine, be on informal probation for 2 years, and perform 250 hours of community service.
love it when you look through some of these, you know, the criminal blotters of all this stuff, you know, like the misdemeanors, and you find that there are legal ways to get by things that you've never heard of before. Have money and you get a deferment from some reason.
Oh, I see this here. There was a crash that damaged his RV, and he sought an estimate from a body shop of $4,600. He then bought insurance and claimed the damage later.
I see.
So
you're not allowed to do that, I don't think.
So he faced three felony charges of filing a false insurance claim, filing a false statement in connection with an insurance claim, and concealing a material fact in connection with an insurance claim.
Yeah, that's big money, Dan.
There was a maximum penalty of 5 years in jail.
Once you go up against the big moneyed institutions, felonies start to pop up pretty quick.
Dealing with RV insurance? I didn't know that was a big deal.
Geico, they're all over the place.
But this was Progressive in this case.
Ah,
this
well, don't mess with Flo.
No, and she's really, really, really trying to work to show you her acting chops, isn't she?
She was, if I remember right, she was a stand-up comedian who had just kind of lucked into, remember there were, at the time, I forget the other ones, but there were a couple of commercial campaigns that people, the Dos Equis guy, right? I mean, there were
Jonathan Goldsmith.
Characters that got thrown into these campaigns, and they were just career makers. The dude, the Verizon guy, right? Can you hear me now, that whole thing?
There's Mayhem for Allstate.
Career-making things. And even though that guy was on 30 Rock, Dennis Duffy, I think was his name on the show, that was a great show. You saw a bunch of commercials like that where you just had this recurring character go through and career-making things. But at the same time, you do that and you're never anything else.
That would say Ian Eagle's dad, Brother Dominic, in the Xerox ads.
Never anything else.
They still would remember him as Brother Dominic, the monk that would use the Xerox copying machines. Yeah, that's true. And that's when you grow up with like a spokesperson and you never knew why that person was famous. Like you only knew somebody.
I was driving around today. Is Tom Baudette someone? Because he's always going to leave the light on for you at Motel 6, but I have no idea who the hell he is.
Tom Baudette, it was an Alaskan-based radio broadcaster who's also a panelist on, like, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He was always sort of just a very dry...
He's got a great voice.
Yeah, he was a radio broadcaster, I believe.
He looks exactly like he sounds.
Yes.
Does he?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Oh,
yes.
That's perfect.
He is on that list of people who look exactly like they sound, without question. Yeah, that was like, there was the whole Mariette Hartley, James Garner Polaroid commercials. And everybody thought that Mariette Hartley was actually James Garner's wife just because they were
but not.
No, just they were just really good actors because they're acting. They pretend things
acting.
For a living. Acting! I am the thespian. Yeah. Stephanie Courtney, that's Flo's name? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
But just, okay, I get it. You're probably a better actor than some of these things show, even though you're making bank on this particular campaign.
Imagine the pitch meetings for that. Yeah, Flo's going to have this extended family, and we're really going to get into, you know, the things that you want to do with this character in 90 seconds of an ad.
Hey,
less than
good for her. I mean, it's enough that she could probably buy another house.
You mentioned the uneven start for the Cubs to begin the season,
it's
and
weird.
Some of the numbers
again.
Right,
it's a really weird season.
There is one Cub whose underlying numbers might be a little more heartening than you think, and he's also a guy that you early on, Dan, have championed in a particular spot in the lineup.
We'll
get to that when we come back.
On Sports Radio 670, The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Back at it on the Bernstein and McKnight Show here on 670, The Score. Talking a little baseball, despite the weather outside. The snow, Dan, has, well, it's kind of stopped whipping around here on the ninth floor. A little bit, somewhat. Not so much, though. I mentioned you have a shortstop that you've kind of liked so far this season.
Yes.
Kind of liked some of the ABs despite some of the stats. You are not alone. In The Athletic, Eno Saris had a little write-up on some of the ridiculousness, the comeback, obviously, the Cubs had against the Braves over the weekend. And he writes this about Cubs shortstop Addison Russell. In the top of the second inning, Russell took a walk off Sean Newcomb, which isn't the toughest job in baseball, but it highlights why he's excited about the Cubs righty to finally come through on more of his promise. The shortstop is showing his best walk and strikeout rates right now. And though it's too early to believe in those numbers, the underlying supporting numbers are almost in a large enough quantity to believe. In other words, he's swinging and reaching less than ever while swinging at the same amount of strikes. He's also lifting the ball well and nearing the moment when that lift shows a real adjustment has happened. With a real improvement in contact and patience, which he's showing, it seems, Russell could put together a 275, 345, 455 kind of season with great defense to boot. Four shortstops. This is what I was really surprised about.
Okay.
Four shortstops had an 800 OPS last year, and he's only 24 and should be improving after the year he had in 2017. Let's hope some growth in both his game and maturity. So I looked through and I thought, okay, Russell's number is obviously not that solid to start, or are they? It's a 213 batting average, it's a 339 on base, and it's a 298 slugging. Now, obviously, the bookend numbers there are bad, but if he indeed is hitting into a lot of bad luck, or at least some of it, which is 260, sorry, I wrote it down, 263? Yeah, 263 BABIP would indicate, then you've got some room for growth. If Saris is happy with some of the contact rates, some of the not swinging at crap,
right,
you know, and kind of fixing some of those issues there, then you have, yet again, at an elite defensive position, a player that could help buoy you through times of swing and miss trouble. That sounds like a John Denver song or something. Buoy you through times of trouble in a swing and miss offense like the Cubs are set up to have.
I've always loved his game, and when they traded for him in unlikely fashion, the question around baseball was, how can Billy Beane give up on a guy who could be Barry Larkin? And we've been very patient with Addison Russell. Truth be told, he should probably have announced his arrival at an elite level more significantly. Some of this is obscured by the fact that, yeah, the guy has huge three-run home runs in World Series games.
Right.
I mean, he's done a lot of big things.
Well, Joe talks a lot about his penchant for driving in runners, which you can, if you want to evaluate that from one way or another, feel free.
I see, but the metric perspective on that that's the whole RBI thing. There is no unique skill to driving in runners.
Right.
You are a hitter, and either you have opportunities of guys on base when you hit, or you don't, and you are who you are.
I guess with Russell, you know, looking back at his Cub career, which is the only place he's played Major League Baseball, the whole 2016, 238, 321, 417, 738 OPS and 94 OPS plus. I think a lot, especially with an all-star nod and it finished 19th in MVP voting at shortstop in the National League, which matters to me. I think from there, you start to make some pretty large jumps. I think after the 2016 season, for some pretty obvious reasons, a lot of folks wanted to take some pretty large jumps talent-wise for every single one of this young Cubs core. And it happens with Bryant, and it happens with Rizzo, and the other guys just kind of tend to support the rest or fill in the gaps from time to time. I think in a pretty real way, whether it's analysts or fans, they're looking for another tentpole to that offense.
You know, he's a win-because-of guy. He has to be. If he's going to fulfill his pedigree, he is an absolute win-because-of guy. And Russell was bad last year. He was only he wasn't even a two-win player last year.
84 OPS plus.
It's terrible.
I don't have the WOBA in front of me, but that's got to be somewhere around that.
Weighted runs created plus of 84, weighted on base average of 305. And right now, the problem is the ISO number at 085.
Sure.
But you got a slug.
Well, the lift numbers, hopefully, are like Saris pointed out, are hopefully going up. And what's weird, and we'll talk to Jeff Sullivan about this week, but what's weird is fly ball rates this year so far. And yeah, weather, I think, is going to be a big part of the conversation, because all around the country, you either have had, you know, 21 games canceled, or you've had crap weather where it's difficult to get things out. The fly ball rates aren't converting into home runs exactly the way we thought. It's shifted some, and it's, again, probably too early to, the snow would indicate, it's probably too early to put a generalized, you know, assessment on it, but it seems as though we're playing something different right now.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This segment brought to you by KFC. KFC's $20 fill-ups will feed a family of four with eight pieces of delicious Kentucky Fried Chicken, two sides of taters and gravy, coleslaw, and four flaky biscuits for just $20. KFC, it's finger-licking good. There's a chart here that was sent by Scott from Davenport, Scott Lindholm, and he's tracking game time temperature of 40 degrees or below going back to the turn of the century. And this is the home team only baseball reference data. In 2018 already, we're on April 16th, is that right?
April 16th.
There have been 29 game time temperatures of 40 degrees or below.
It's really cold.
29. For full seasons, the other full seasons coming close to that, 2003 had 21, 2007 had 20.
In a whole season?
The entire season. 2013 had 19, and 2014 had 16. We are already at 29 frigid games that have been played.
There's so much baseball that we haven't seen so far this season, and last night we got a gift. Last night we had pure joy showered down upon us in the form of Bartolo Colon. That was beautiful.
He's 44 years old.
Absolutely beautiful.
And when you check on Twitter and you see that he's flirting with a perfect game and carrying a no-hitter to the eighth inning.
Against Houston Astros.
The Astros.
It's real damn offense.
And then you get all these tweets of everybody coming out with all of these never-befores and the uniqueness of this. And the guy's throwing, what, like 85 miles an hour?
85, 88.
85 to 88 with good downward movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, anywhere movement.
44 years, 326 days, the oldest pitcher to ever carry a no-hitter into the eighth inning. No pitcher at this age had gone more than seven innings and allowed one hit. And the sinker still works, whatever you want to call it, the two-seam movement. Jeff Passan noted at one point he had 26 consecutive fastballs that he had thrown. Cespedes Family Barbecue notes, Bartolo Colon is older than six current big league managers. Bartolo Colon wearing number 42 in honor of both Jackie Robinson and his age 2 years ago.
Did you see some of the swings Jose Altuve was taking against him?
Yes, and then Chris Kamka of NBC Sportsnet Chicago. Bartolo Colon is the last remaining active pitcher to have pitched at the Astrodome.
He is Colon, the last pitcher, 44 years or older, having two starts of six-plus innings and just the one run is Nolan Ryan. And then Brandon McCarthy, actually, you follow Brandon McCarthy on Twitter, right? So this was all, was as it was happening. McCarthy tweets out, Bannister will be nervous about Bartolo's pitch count soon. Anything more than 300 and he'll risk not pitching in his 50s.
Look.
He can go forever.
There have been guys who have pitched in foreign leagues, into the Mexican League and in various, whether it's winter ball in Venezuela, other guys. There's all sorts, you know, Satchel Paige doesn't have to necessarily be the go-to example.
But I was looking up Satchel Paige.
And even when you watch the coaches who throw BP, when you actually see you know, like Tommy Lasorda did it into his 70s.
Yes.
But he was still out there actually throwing batting practice. There's guys who
did it every now and again.
Who still throw hard.
Jimmy Leland did not. He didn't give a damn. He was not out there throwing BP.
I always liked watching that. That's when you see somebody who was at that level, and then you kind of look. I've played in men's leagues against old guys. You laugh and you see the starting pitcher like, oh my, we're gonna kill this guy, and then he throws you two knuckleballs and you go sit down. He's like, what the hell just happened?
Slow two seamers. That, I mean, we were talking about this too. Yesterday was a big day for starters around the league. A lot of strikeouts. Syndergaard was fantastic.
Oh my god, the videos of some of what Syndergaard is doing is ridiculous.
He had a bad first two innings, inefficient. First two innings, kept everybody off the board, and then struck out eight in a row to essentially end his day. He left, blah, 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 I think a single into right and then a runner on and that kind of thing. But the stuff that he's throwing, that two-seamer, and I have to imagine, you know, we don't see it the same way because I don't think, well, maybe now and maybe today, places like MLB Network will break down Bartolo Colon's start and we'll see the grips, we'll see the pitch manipulation and stuff. But with Syndergaard, we see it all the time, right? I mean, that's just part of having watched a Syndergaard start. The way he's able to move the baseball, the way he's able to do it at that velocity is unbelievable. It's uncanny kind of stuff.
There was an argument made, I think it was Will Carroll, who said, at some point, when do we call that two-seamer with that kind of wrist snap and that kind of pronation, the inside-out movement, when do we call it a screwball?
Yeah, because the difference is how do you want to term it? Do you want to term it from the hitter's point of view? Because a hitter doesn't give one iota what you've got on the baseball. Well, your hand anyway. Right. Foreign substance, maybe so much. But they don't care how you're gripping it. They care what it looks like on the way up there.
When Greg Maddux was in his second iteration as a Cub, and he was throwing low and slow and everything, good barbecue is everything he could do to upset timing. Bob Brenly referred to Maddux's sinker to a left-handed hitter as the off-the-body sinker.
Okay.
And he would aim it at the front hip of the left-handed hitter, and it would fade. It wouldn't snap. It would just sort of and he would sort of jump back, and it would fall over that corner for a strike. Or he would dive after it, and it would tail out of the zone. And I always thought that if that's not a screwball, what is? The fact, though, you didn't see with Maddux, you didn't see – he was always able to get just crazy action on a ball anyway.
But unreal.
But you didn't see the severe turn that Syndergaard is doing, where he's really snapping.
He's not late.
He's not rolling the hand over. Mm-hmm. He's firing it like you would a curveball.
I'd always been – remember, Hector Santiago, his first go-around with the White Sox, had a screwball coming up. But he – you know, there was a lot of back and forth – about whether or not it was just a turnover change or whether it was a screwball. And I think, I want to say somebody asked Don Cooper about it, about what he threw, and think the answer was something to the effect of, who gives a damn? I mean, it's just...
Right, I just wonder why the
way
term,
it's moving.
People stopped using the term in the 70s. They talked about it. It was, you snap your wrist this way for a curveball. You snap your wrist this way, and if it moves away, it's called a screwball.
I always thought, not that it really matters, because I'm sure you could teach that turnover from a different angle, but if you had change up grip and were turning things over, not necessarily a circle. I mean, some guys will pop the thumb up or just like stuff it in the back of your hand, that kind of thing.
The Burley Glavin
grip. Vulcan change even, kind of. You could do that some too.
Or you do what Maddux did, and that's just throw a fastball with your outer two fingers.
Right. And so as you start to do that and turn the thing over more with a change up grip, that's when you start getting called the screwball. That's that from what I understand.
I thought that was just a turnover change.
See, I thought so too, and I don't really – nobody seems to have a line that delineates. I'm sure someone does. Some old crusty pitching coach probably does, but I've never had anyone draw the line for me, and I've asked.
That's like the difference between a fork ball and a split-finger fastball, which are different pitches.
They are.
The Bruce Sutter famous fork ball involved – it's where the thumb position is, and are you pushing – because a fork ball acts more like a knuckleball.
Right.
Where you almost push it through the two fingers with your thumb, and it flutters and drops. Where a split-finger fastball, you simply get the tumbling action.
You're pulling it more than you're –
right, because you're pulling the front of the ball,
right,
and then it ends up sort of flopping the back of the ball over as it tumbles.
And I don't – that's got a line. I mean, guys with the splitter and the fork, they are two different pitches. But for this, I mean, everybody – I don't know if people just give up. Just like, yeah, just turn your hand over and that's fine, and pitching coaches are good with whatever you're throwing up there. But it seems to me – who's the last guy that taught a screwball? You mean Coop has the cutter thing going on, and you know, Ray Searidge has taught his kind of version of a splitter the last couple of years in Pittsburgh. And as you go back, I can't think of any pitching coaches who got brought into the league or arrived at the league with a history of teaching the screwball.
Now, you always had Roger Craig, who was famous with the split-finger fastball. I'm trying to remember. I remember talking to former Cub and White Sox pitcher Jason Beret about his changeup. He called it a fosh ball.
A fosh ball?
A fosh ball. It was spelled F-O-C-H, and it was sort of a portmanteau of fork change. F-O for fork and C-H for change.
Oh.
Look it up. Because
I don't
remember who he – and he told me who taught it to him. But he said that was just another way of gripping the ball that was comfortable to him that kept it back in his hand.
Yeah, the first result is Ancestry.com. Apparently there was a man named Wilson Foshball.
That's who it was, ironically enough.
Wilson Foshball.
Actually, it was taught to him by Wilson Foshball, and it had nothing to do with the fact that it was a fork
Mount
change.
Fosh. It's located on the border of Alberta and British Columbia,
see,
on the Continental Divide.
It's possible somebody spelled it F-O-S-H.
Named after Marshall Ferdinand Foch.
There was a pitch, a fork change version, an amalgam called a Foshball.
Okay.
The segment brought to you by Burlington. Refresh your spring closet for less at your your Burlington store. What's hot? Stripes, dots, and gingham, plus cool hardware like pearls, sequins, grommets, and much more. Burlington style for everyone. The Bears have made it official. They have signed wide receiver Benny Fowler to a one-year deal. Another wide receiver is added to the core to help Mitchell Trubisky do what he does. So a reminder, top of the hour, we are going to do the midday midway. Dan Wetzel is going to join us at noon. And in the noon hour, a special Bernstein and McKnight programming announcement that I think is going to please you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, can we talk a little bit about Derrick Rose when we come back?
Sure.
Can I just bounce a couple of things about Derrick Rose off of you and really the Timberwolves in general last night?
Okay, we're going to do that next on The Score.
Beautiful.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Charles Barkley on TNT. Them dummies don't do that.
It was, you know, I'm watching the Timberwolves Rockets game last night, Dan, and I'm closer than I thought it would be kind of throughout. And yeah, James Harden went off and Chris Paul had a really rough night. And for what it's worth, they didn't make the shots that they usually make for most of that first half. It wasn't really until that third quarter. It wasn't really until Derrick Rose keyed in and had some decent minutes himself. But it wasn't really, it seemed to me, until Derrick Rose checked in and started checking James Harden until things really started to go the other way. And I guess, you know, in watching the game, I understood cognitively that Derrick Rose had re-teamed up with Tom Thibodeau and with Jimmy Butler and with Taj Gibson. I understood that he was there and that I was going to see him play, but I guess I hadn't wanted to pay enough attention to him coming off the bench in that situation. And it was a little bit to me, you know, he's got the longer hair now. He's got the beard going on. It was a little bit to me like watching the sequel of a superhero movie. And then out of the shadows comes the superhero, you know, just kind of beleaguered and haggard. And I'm too old for this anymore. And it's kind of that guy, but it's not the same guy. You see some good moves, but not all of them. He goes up for, after Harden had put Wiggins to sleep on a step back three, just as he started to really take off, just as the Rockets started to really exert some control, despite the Timberwolves getting it back to a three-point game late, he put Wiggins to sleep, popped a three. Rose comes out on him at the top and jumps for some inexplicable reason from a foot and a half away, jumps to defend Harden's three. There's no point in doing that.
He uses the Jedi mind trick on people. Harden makes people do things they know they're not supposed to do.
So, of course, Rose jumps, and he fouls Harden. He makes the bucket. It's a four-point play. And it's the most explainable. It's the most understand. Yeah, thought that was going to happen. Figured that would be there. And it's back to what we heard Barkley say coming out of the break. I don't know. I forget if it was Geltzeiler. I think it was Geltzeiler like 2 weeks ago, talking about Tom Thibodeau and his reputation for defense and about how, you know, is that all Tom Thibodeau, or is some of that having Kevin Garnett? Is that all Tom Thibodeau, or some of that having Joakim Noah at his prime, being able to move in and out between the lane and being able to close off those drives? I don't necessarily say. We had Jim Suhan on. He called this a referendum. That last game of the season, he called it a referendum on Tom Thibodeau. And I'm not so sure that this series will be because of who they're facing. But some of the decisions that are being made, some of the ways that Tom Thibodeau and that Timberwolves team are deciding to match things up are the little things that you can control in a series against a team like the Rockets, the little things, they seem to be choosing the wrong way on just about all of them.
There's, for somebody as talented as Karl-Anthony Towns, they need to do some of, at least in my opinion, when you watch the way the Pelicans would use Boogie Cousins or would use, and now with Anthony Davis, they don't overthink it. If he's got a height mismatch, they lob it to him. They just throw it to him at the rim. He'll point. And you can do some of that with Karl-Anthony Towns, where they switch the screen. It's an elbow screen, right? Your foul line extended. You get the switch. Immediately, all he has to do is go right to the basket.
Right.
Now, where Tom Thibodeau, when he was asked about it, and what got him mad was his belief is that a guy like Karl-Anthony Towns will make opportunities for himself by running as hard as he can.
Sprint.
End.
Sprint.
End. Sprint.
How many times did he say sprint in the post game last night? Four or five.
That's like when Scott Skiles was asked about Eddie Curry. What does he have to do to be a better rebounder? His response? Jump. He has to jump to be a better rebounder.
So to me, the question I have there is it really sprinting that's going to make Karl Anthony Towns a better option against the Rockets? Is it really working harder? Because it seems to me that's what makes you feel good in a post-game press conference, saying those words. Whereas getting him the ball and finding the mismatches that you heard Charles Barkley talking about when we came back, those things are the things that might actually do something. And I know I'm kind of tilting at a first-round matchup that's already set that the Rockets will win and move on with, but I think because of Jimmy Butler's injury earlier this season, they went 8-9 without him. So, you know, they treaded water, I guess, in a tough Western Conference, but they lost to a lot of bad teams, even when Butler came back, even when they were out. I guess to me, I'm looking at a team that wanted to announce themselves this season. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear a whole lot of announcing. I heard a lot more from the Pelicans this year. I heard a lot more from the Blazers this year than I did from the Timberwolves. And I'm just starting to wonder, you know, when does the shouting become a little bit more performative than it does substantive? Because to me, we're kind of getting, we might be at that point. Not saying that there's not a year for them to run. Not saying that Andrew Wiggins can't suddenly wake up and come into his own and be the guy that Tom Thibodeau needs him to be offensively with Butler on or off the floor. But to me, I'm looking at that team and wondering.
When you watch what Giannis Antetokounmpo can do when he decides to do it, and he was doing it multiple times in multiple ways in that game against the Celtics, what does he have? And he's probably a better pure ball handler than Karl Anthony Towns.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's still the same kind of thing where he recognizes a mismatch, and sometimes it's on the dead run. Sometimes he will catch a ball at midcourt, coming out off an outlet, and realize that between here and the basket, this guy can't stop me.
He's most incredible to me in transition like that. To get all those angles and limb, as an angular guy myself, being able to move all that in the right direction and seeing and recognizing it's incredible.
You'd like to see Towns do some of that, but everybody's so deferential to Butler. Have you noticed that?
The last shot where Jimmy's twisting, turning, and taking a long two was a bad idea?
In general, though. In general, the amount of time on their shot clock they spend making sure Jimmy has his Jimmy time. You know, that Jimmy gets his sort of executive moments to preen and pose with the basketball. That maybe that's not the right basketball play all the time.
And they were giving him time to do all those things despite clearly not being able to get into where he wanted to get into. I know he said before the game, if I'm out there, I'm healthy. But that's tough talk, and I don't mind that. In the playoffs, that's what you're supposed to do. Donovan Mitchell was trying to do the same thing on his bench when the training staff was telling him, nah, you got your foot stepped on, you have to play. Mitchell was screaming to get back into that game, which was great. But to run that offense, or at least to demand the touches and the possessions at the expense of Karl Anthony Towns and the mismatches we're talking about, for Jimmy Butler, a compromised Jimmy Butler, it doesn't make sense to me.
That's Connor McKnight. I'm Dan Bernstein. We're going to hit the midway coming up next. And there was something that happened in golf over the weekend that was actually part of our discussion regarding a possibility in baseball. And the powers that be in golf made a decision that it was the kind of thing that we had discussed, maybe if baseball could do something similar. But of course, no good deed goes unpunished, and there were people unhappy about it.
I watched some boxing last night from about 30 years ago and was shocked. I'll tell you why. I'd never heard of this before.
Okay.
I'd never seen anything like this before. It was amazing.
I also have a counterintuitive explanation about this lawsuit that's being filed by a New Orleans Saints cheerleader with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission regarding gender discrimination at work, and why it is a thorny legal issue that may ultimately be unsatisfying in how it's finally adjudicated.
Thorny legal issues are my favorite kinds.
Oh, good.
I love the thorny ones.
All that and more coming your way on the Midway next on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.